NHPR's Leadership Circle is a community of listeners who place a high value on thorough and thoughtful journalism. I'm Sarah Alter, Director of Major Giving. As a member of the Leadership Circle, your monthly investment of $100 or a single gift of $1,200 helps us create and deliver the news you trust and the programs you love. Take a moment to think about the essential role NHPR plays in your life and consider deepening your commitment to the station. Give online at nhpr.org/leaders.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. As uncertainty reigns and votes are still being counted in the presidential campaign, this hour on The Exchange, we update you on key New Hampshire contests, where the top races are settled. Overall, it was a good night for incumbents in the Granite State, with Governor Sununu, Senator Shaheen, Congresswoman Custer, and Congressman Pappas all winning re-election. At this point, it's still unclear what the balance of power will be at the State House and on the Executive Council. Exchange listeners, what's your reaction to the outcome here in New Hampshire and to voting day itself, given the huge number of absentee ballots cast this year? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Dan Barrick, NHPR's news director, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Paula Tracy, senior reporter for InDepthNH.org. Well, welcome to everybody. Thanks for being here in the morning after a late night for all of us. And Dan Barrick, before we talk about the results, let's talk about the voting itself going in. What were the concerns, Dan?
Sure. That was as much of a part of the story, I think, heading into Election Day for many people as, you know, some of the questions about the candidates and the results. So obviously the pandemic really changed much of how this year's election was being carried out. State officials back in the spring changed state policy around election to essentially allow any voter who had a concern about their personal health related to the coronavirus could request an absentee ballot and vote absentee. That's a big change. New Hampshire typically has fairly, you know, strict regulations about who's eligible for an absentee ballot. The result of that, as we know, as we've been reporting, is really a record number of absentee ballot requests. So one of the things we were looking at was just how would, in the days leading up to the election and actual election day, when those ballots would actually be counted by local clerks, how would that stress the system potentially? The answer to that seems to be not so bad. It sounds like in most cities and towns, clerks were able to sort of prepare for that, to pre-process many of the absentee ballots and to move them along on election day. There were some concerns, obviously, about, you know, in a time of social distancing, how an event like an election, which brings lots of people together in one place over the course of the day, might be handled. Questions of mask use. By and large, we heard of very few reports of conflicts over folks who, you know, either refused to wear masks or concerns about lack of social distancing. There was also concern, around potential disturbances or protests or other kinds of, disruptions at the polling place. You know, the president had urged his supporters weeks ago to quote, watch what's happening at the polls. And there were some concerns about what that might mean in terms of potential disruption at the polling place. Again, we had reporters across the state at several dozen polling places over the course of the day. We saw very little that seemed out of the ordinary from a normal election. Long lines for sure. There were different visuals with the mask wearing and people standing 6 feet apart in the lines. But by and large, it seems like the state's election infrastructure handled yesterday quite well.
Yeah, a friend of mine worked at his local polling place and was very impressed with just how smoothly it went and how people seemed to know what they were doing, even with the large crowds. I want to play a little bit from some of our election officials here in the state. They were certainly preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. Here's Assistant Attorney General Nick Chong-Yen talking on WMUR and saying, for the most part, the election appeared to go smoothly. Let's hear.
We had been fielding calls throughout the day, and we were successful in addressing a large majority of those calls and helping both voters and election officials resolve any sort of issues that had come up in real time. So there may certainly be follow-up to come in the the days or weeks following the election, but we were able to address a lot of these things and ran these election day operations as we normally do.
And again, that's Assistant Attorney General Nick Chong-Yen. We also heard again on WMUR from Deputy Secretary of State Dave Scanlon talking about how the somewhat delayed results in those congressional races especially was perhaps due to the unprecedented volume of absentee ballots cast. Let's hear.
Well, there was a tremendous volume of absentee ballots that were cast in this election that far exceeded anything that we've seen in the past. Almost 250,000 absentee ballots were cast. And in the last presidential general election, we had 75,000. So you can see that there is a large volume. And along with that goes a lot of paperwork, a lot of handling, a lot of processing. And those are the issues that some of the cities and towns are still dealing with, trying to move all that paperwork through so they can get those ballots counted.
Again, that's Deputy Secretary of State Dave Scanlon speaking on WMUR. Paula Tracy, you went to 9 polling places yesterday, put 150 miles on your car. That is real shoe leather reporting there, Paula. What did you see in terms of the voting and in terms of people voting in a pandemic?
Well, I visited polls in Lebanon, Haverhill, Plymouth, and then some small towns like Grafton and Warren. And there were early lines, but it got steady voting all through the day once the early rush cleared. And many moderators were saying they were seeing record turnouts of people they knew and tons of new same-day registrants, which really brought they were just so pleased with the turnout. Many voters I tried to speak to did not want to say who they were supporting, and that seemed more than usual. I've been doing this since 1988, and it seemed like more reticence this year. Some were just saying they were sick of the rancor, and they wanted it to be over, and then some had said that they changed their mind even at the last minute, which kind of surprised me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Paula, like you said, you've been reporting for a long time, but this year people were more hesitant to say, you know, yeah, my name is Jane Smith, and I voted for, you know, President Trump and Governor Sununu. Yeah. People didn't want to tell you that this year.
No, but the focus really was on the president race. I do feel that the turnout was because of the presidential year, that it was so big, and that it was so divisive in terms of, you know, ideologically very different. And people were kind of saying that they didn't want their neighbors to necessarily know that they voted for either Biden or Trump, not so much about Sununu or Feltes, but about that top ticket race. And I just think they were saying that the climate, the differences between their neighbors has never been more stark this year. And I think they were a little bit more hesitant to tell me much about what they did for a vote. The one thing that I did ask them, I had a same question for voters, and it was, how is this year different for them? And I also asked it for moderators, too. And other than the fact that they were standing in line with masks, you know, they just were seemingly concerned about the freedom of the country and the importance of their civic engagement. And I found that to be really heartening. I was very, very pleased to see so many people. The moderators, they said they noticed fewer children coming through. Usually they see more children, and parents like to bring their young ones. But because of the pandemic, there were fewer children at the polls this year. And also the weather. It was really bitter cold. I basically was on the western part of the state, and there was blowing wind and snow and leaves, and they were standing all in there. It takes a while for me to get my winter blood going and feel warm, and they were just shivering, but they weren't going to be turned away. They were there for the long haul. I also spoke to some elderly who were very pleased that they had decided to go with the absentee ballot. So,
Dean Spiliotis, I want to turn to you just talking about voting itself for a couple more minutes, because again, going into the election, this was just as big a story as the actual races themselves. So, Dean, what were the expectations going in about this situation, a presidential election, at a time when people were trying to stay safe from a highly contagious virus?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, as Paula suggested, typically in a presidential election year, you expect higher turnout than you're going to see at a midterm election. But the pandemic introduced a whole new level of uncertainty. You'll recall back during some of the spring state primaries in places like Wisconsin, as we were in the middle of one of the earlier spikes in coronavirus, there were scenes of people waiting in line at polls, and even some reports of some folks contracting coronavirus as they waited online for several hours. So there just was a lot of fear and anxiety going into this, where, you know, voters are confronting a situation where they feel like it's a crucial national election. They desperately want to participate, but they're also concerned about their health. And as we saw, you know, there were some real differences in terms of how people assessed the threat of the pandemic. The Republicans tended to weigh the risk less heavily than Democrats, which is one reason why we saw such high early voting and mail-in voting among Democrats. So there are some differences in how people perceive the risk. But you look at the level of turnout, which has been just remarkable. And I think part of that is, you know, people have been living with this for a while now. Part of that is you know, municipalities, states, local election organizations have a better sense of how to do this safely. But it is remarkable to me, in talking anecdotally to people I know around the state and around the country, talking to people who voted mail-in because of coronavirus, who it's the first time they voted mail-in in, you know, 20, 30 or more years. So there was a lot of newness around this. I think as we got closer, in some sense, people seeing that, you know, almost 100 million people voted in advance, maybe eased, even though there were lines at the polls on election day, kind of eased a little bit of the anxiety, because you knew the crush of people showing up was not going to be quite as large. And in general, the states and localities did a really strong job of doing this safely. And that's a good thing to see, because I think so many people believed that there's just so much at stake in this particular election, whichever side of the outcome you're on.
Well, I'd love to hear from listeners this hour about how their voting experience went. So join us, Exchange listeners, at 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, you can use Twitter. Tell us how your voting experience went, either by absentee or at the polls. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. One more question about voting, and Paula, to you, please. You've spoken several times right around the election with Secretary of State Bill Gardner. What did he tell you? What were his observations about how the voting went this year?
Well, I pulled over on the side of the road in Piermont next to a herd of Black Angus cattle, and was able to get through to Bill Gardner at the State House around 1 yesterday. And then again last night we spoke at about 8 o'clock. And he was telling me at 1 o'clock that things were going relatively smoothly. He had been speaking with Attorney General's office personnel throughout the morning, and that they were seeing a large turnout, very few issues, some related to people who refused to wear masks. And how they were being treated. We looked at the issues on the voter law log from the Attorney General's office in the September primary, and found a lot of the issues that people were complaining about were related to the masks. But he said that in general, everything was going very smoothly. He had expectations that it was possible that we would have the highest as a percent of the available voters, the highest since John Kennedy won in the 1960s for president, and that was at about, he said, 78% turnout.
Wow.
So he was looking for a big turnout, and he went to four different polling places, as he does usually. He picks at random. He went to Derry, then he went to Ward 4 in Dover, and then he was in Portsmouth and rounded out his day in Seabrook, just to observe the polling and to answer questions, and just sort of, he fades back and sits for half an hour or so, watches the process, and he was feeling very positive about the way that things went last night. He expected that we would not be waiting, you know, very long. And he also noted that if there are going to be any recounts, that he has reserved the National Guard Armory space for social distancing for recounts to occur.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. Sounds like he put as many miles on his car yesterday as you did, Paula. Dan Barrick, I have a question for you, Dan. So once the legislature is settled, and that takes a little longer to figure out, so I want to let listeners know, yes, NHPR is definitely tracking the balance of power in the legislature, the state house, the state senate, the executive council. It just takes longer for those races to be called. But Dan, once the legislature is settled, it'll choose the next secretary of state. The secretary of state is not chosen by the public. He or she is not appointed by the governor. So what are the prospects for Secretary of State Gardner, Dan Barrick?
Well, at this moment, it's really hard to say. If you remember 2 years ago, as you said, Laura, the members of the legislature elect the Secretary of State before they begin a new two-year session between the first start of the day of the session and the November election. 2 years ago, Bill Gardner's been Secretary of State for four decades. 2 years ago was really the most competitive race that for re-election he's had pretty much since he first took office. And at the time, the message he was sending to folks was, almost one of, please allow me this one last term so that I can preside over the what he was calling the 100th anniversary of the New Hampshire First in the Nation primary earlier this year, essentially signaling this, you know, I'll stand down after this. He didn't say that explicitly, but reading between the lines, that was the expectation. Right now, you know, if you talk to folks in politics, divining the intention of Bill Gardner is a tricky task in any moment. But I think right now, you know, is he perhaps feeling energized by the turnout and the success, you know, by and large of this race right now? If you remember, you know, for decades, Bill Gardner had earned a reputation as had earned bipartisan support in his reelection effort 2 years ago. It was largely partisan, with Republicans really in the legislature supporting him and Democrats, you know, not uniformly, but by and large opposing him. Depending, I think a lot of it will come down to the makeup of the legislature and whether or not, you know, whatever Bill Gardner's personal desire is to continue doing the job or retire, but also looking at what is the composition of the legislature. And it appears likely that it's set to limit a reelection from him. He make a decision there. But right now, it's sort of anyone's guess, I would say, just on the looking at the public record about what the next Secretary of State, who that will be.
Sure. And I know listeners want to know about the State House, the State Senate, the Executive Council, and NHPR for sure is tracking that. We are still waiting for the AP to declare winners in 15 state Senate races out of 24. So a lot of races still outstanding there, as well as in all five Executive Council districts. So we're definitely keeping an eye on that, on the Exchange and Dan Barrick and his news team. But for now, that's what we have with those sort of down ballot races. We are going to take a very quick station break, and when we come back, I do want to talk about the governor's race, also how the presidential election kind of trickled down to state races this year. And listeners, let's hear from you. If you want to talk about what your voting experience was like yesterday, or if you voted absentee, or your thoughts on some of the outcomes that we saw pretty early in the night here in the Granite State, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Back to our conversation about the elections and results in New Hampshire's top races. Incumbents all won their seats at the so-called top of the ticket for governor, U.S. Senate, and our two congressional seats. And Democrat Joe Biden won our state's 4 electoral college votes. Exchange listeners, what's your reaction to the outcome here in New Hampshire and an unusual voting day itself? Let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Dan Barrick, NHPR's news director, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at SNHU, and Paula Tracy, senior reporter for In-Depth NH. And all of you, let's talk about the governor's race decided very early. I think it was even before 8:30. He was the lone Republican to win a top slot in the state. Dan Barrick, how did the governor do that in a year that was otherwise very good for New Hampshire Democrats?
Yeah, not only was he the lone Republican to win at the top of the ticket in New Hampshire, he appears at this hour to be the biggest winner, to have won the most number of votes. He's looking a roughly more than 30% margin over his Democratic opponent.
Oh, wow.
I think you can attribute several factors to it. I think we'd have to maybe make the main one be to look at just the events of the last 6 to 8 months. The pandemic really did shape the political and policy climate in the state house. With the legislature essentially, packing up business for a significant part of that, working remotely, doing their business remotely, essentially left Sununu with a clear stage to both dominate the political landscape, but also manage the pandemic essentially with a free hand. If you may recall, he essentially asserted early on that he had sole authority to distribute the federal relief money. Democrats sued him over that, claiming that they had equal power to distribute that. Sununu won that in court. He was holding, daily, early on in the pandemic, daily press conferences, giving an update. And I think if you look at the pollings and some of the public approval ratings, by and large, most voters felt that he did a good job managing the state through the crisis. I think the fact that the state, while there are some certain black spots in how we handle the pandemic in terms of the number of the percent of nursing home deaths, by and large, the fact that the state has escaped the kinds of infection rates that other parts of the country are seeing helped too. But I think Sununu was able to make this race largely one around management and experience, and the fact that he was essentially campaigning as a crisis governor allowed him to make that case and essentially deny a lot of oxygen to Dan Feltes, his Democratic opponent.
Well, and Paul and Dean, I want to hear from you too on this. But first, let's hear from the governor himself. And as Dan said, he won a third term handily. In his acceptance speech, he urged everybody to put political differences aside. Let's hear.
We know it's like kind of like the Super Bowl, right? There can be bad feelings on one side or the other. But the main message is those feelings end tonight. Tomorrow we come together as neighbors in our communities, understanding we still have a lot of challenges ahead. And if we don't come together one way or the other, and we don't leave the political stuff behind, we're not going to get anywhere. But we've done it before. Like, we have a model of success. This past year has been so trying for so many folks. We get it. There's so many sacrifices that have been made by individuals or businesses or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, everyone took responsibility, not just for themselves, but for their neighbors in their community. And we did it right with our COVID numbers low, our very strong economy. In doing that, we have become that gold standard for the rest of the country. We cannot thank everybody enough. It's a great win. I'm very proud of everything that this whole team has helped us do. There's a lot of faith in the administration, a lot of faith for the people of New Hampshire. We cannot thank all of you enough. This is New Hampshire. We're the gold standard. Thank you to this great state. Let's get back to work. Thank you guys very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, again, that's Governor Sununu easily and early winning a third term. So, Dean Spiliotis, in that clip, the governor says New Hampshire is the gold standard, at least in terms of the pandemic, though Dr. Fauci says Vermont is the gold standard. Setting that aside, though, how did the pandemic affect Sununu's reelection, Dean?
Well, I think it's certainly in comparison to what we're seeing in the rest of the country, I think Governor Sununu got high marks from New Hampshire voters. Democrats argued that that perhaps we're doing well in comparison to the rest of the country, but not so much when you look at the rest of New England. So that was the argument that they tried to make. And they also made the argument, Dan Feltes in particular, that that Governor Sununu, in moving forward and dealing with the pandemic, tended to favor, business associates, et cetera. We've talked a little bit about the distribution of the emergency funding. So that was the argument they made. You know, obviously, given the margin of victory, New Hampshire voters didn't find that persuasive. You know, the bigger interesting point for Governor Sununu is that, New Hampshire voters historically have a tendency to kind of bracket off the governor's race. So you think about 2010, which was the Tea Party Rebellion, very bad year for Democratic politicians. John Lynch was still reelected, and he was a Democrat, obviously. Governor Sununu has been able to do some of the same in the sense, if you remember back to when Sununu was first elected, he talked a lot about his great working relationship with the Trump administration. He would highlight trips down to Washington to meet with various Trump cabinet officials and talk about how he had the pipeline open, and that was good for New Hampshire in terms of resources for whether we were talking about opioid addiction or education or whatever the issue was. You don't hear much of that anymore. As President Trump's popularity in the state has slid, Governor Sununu backed away from that a little bit. He didn't repudiate Trump. He didn't repudiate the Republican Party, but he adopted the time-honored strategy of making this just about New Hampshire, not about partisan politics. He didn't talk that much about his relationship with President Trump. And in essence, he's done what Jeanne Shaheen has been able to do so successfully over the last 30 years in elected office. And that's really, he's starting to establish his own brand as a politician. And that's the name of the game for running for governor in New Hampshire, to get New Hampshire voters, particularly independents and moderates, to say, yeah, I'm going to vote mostly party ticket on one side, but I'll make an exception for you, Governor Sununu. And that's how you end up with Vice President Biden winning New Hampshire comfortably, the entire congressional delegation, all Democratic, reasonably comfortably, some margins bigger than others. So you have this kind of bracketing off of the governor's race. And I do think that the governor, did a good job of fostering that perspective in New Hampshire voters. And certainly, as we mentioned, his handling of the pandemic, people seem to be generally happy with what he's done.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it, Dean. Sort of New Hampshire voters bracket off the governor, put it in a separate category. Got a couple comments from listeners that I want to share with you. And again, Exchange listeners, tell us how your voting day went, whether you went to the polls or voted absentee, and also what your questions are about some of the results that we're seeing this morning. Lisa in Holderness says, voting in Holderness was flawless. Thank you to town officials and volunteers. Lisa, she also says, thank you to my neighbor, Paula, for her long hours and due diligence. And you certainly did put in long hours and due diligence, Paula, driving around to all those polling stations yesterday. Suzanne writes, what are the implications of Republican control of the New Hampshire Senate and Executive Council, especially for redistricting and court appointments? Even if they're not all called yet, it looks like both are going Republican. And Suzanne, we're definitely keeping an eye on that, the AP results for both the Senate and the Executive Council. But I want to hear from everybody. Paula Tracy, you first. You know, can you talk about how important it is for a Republican governor to have some Republican support in the state Senate and on the Executive Council?
Yes. Well, it's very crucial. And all you have to do is look at the vacant seat for the past 17 months on the state Supreme Court. The governor put the name of his Attorney General, Gordon McDonald, forward. And by a 3-2 Democratic majority, did not get his pick. And he has held it open, hoping that the Executive Council would flip Republican. And right now, it appears that he may be in luck with all but, I think, Dave Wheeler and Deborah Pignatelli's race in District 5. Still too close to call. It appears that that Ted Gatsis will return for District 4.
He's a Republican from Manchester.
Yeah, he's a Republican. Joe Kenney, who held the position after the death of Sorry, I'm forgetting his name. But he held a position prior. And Mike Kreien.
Ray Burton.
Ray Burton, exactly. So he was sort of the heir to Ray Burton's wonderful legacy in the District 1 council seat. Mike Kreien, the Democrat, has held a seat for the past 2 years, but it appears that he has lost that race. Cindy Wormington will, from District 2, will take Andy Valinsky's seat as Andy ran for governor, and it looks like she beat Jim Beard by about 11 points.
Yeah, that's a very Democratic district. Yeah, go ahead.
And then District 3, that was Russell Prescott, the Republican from Kingston, decided not to run for re-election. And it looks like the Republican Janet Stevens of Rye, who also is a big ally of Sununu and ran to basically give him the Republican majority that he wanted, seems to have beat Mindy Messmer in that race. So that's another Republican. And so it'll come down to Pignatelli and Wheeler. And interestingly, if Pignatelli pulls it out, this will be the first time the executive council will have a woman majority. They're not all in the same party, but it would be Wormington, Stevens, and Pignatelli being the women. The Senate race is still really pretty close to call, but it does look like it will flip to the Republicans. We've had a 14-10 majority for Democrats, but there are so many close races, particularly among women who are Democrats, who are in very tight races. That would be like Shannon Chandley, Melanie LeVake, and Jean Deitch. Those guys are all waiting for things to shake out. But for the Republican to be able to have the governors, the executive council, and the Senate will really change things up for the next 2 years, I think.
Wow. So we'll be keeping an eye on that, Dan, for sure. And I know your team in the newsroom will be definitely following these races as they, as we get, you know, final results in. But what are your thoughts on the possibility, Dan, of the New Hampshire Senate going Republican?
Yeah, and I should be clear, we are not, NHPR is not reporting that. We're taking a slightly more cautious approach here. We're relying on the Associated Press for all those races. So there is no, the Associated Press is not calling majority final in any of the executive council races at this point, or in the state Senate. But I think, you know, depending on what happens, we certainly saw in the waning days of the race, Governor Sununu going to bat for many of these down ballot candidates, many of these Republican state Senate candidates trying to, you know, give himself a majority while he's been working with the Democratic majority in the legislature for the last 2 years. It's very interesting, actually, if you listen to his remarks last night that you played just a few minutes ago, Laura, the governor was essentially describing a political situation that has really only existed since the pandemic, where he talked about leadership and getting along and kind of split into two his last term. Before the pandemic, I think it's fair to say his term was marked by pretty much rancor and dissension between him and the Democratic-controlled legislature. We've reported, you know, he had vetoed a record number of bills, Democratic-sponsored bills in that term. You know, the governor does point out, you know, all the bills, he did sign plenty of bills, that is true, but he set a record for the number of vetoes. And I think the pandemic and all the disruption that brought to politics and state house business allowed him to present a sort of cleaner, less fractious front. If in fact Republicans are able to secure majorities in the House and the Senate and the Executive Council, he will actually have that. He will have he will be able to work much more easily in that kind of environment in the next 2 years. But as I said, we're still waiting for the AP to bring in some of those results. They've been trickling in just in the last couple hours, and it's too early to say right now. But as Paula alluded to, many of those races that Democrats had picked up 2 years ago in kind of a good year for Democrats midterm election, you know, sort of swing districts that they won narrowly are on a razor's edge right now as we're still waiting for those results to come in and could easily flip back to Republican control.
Oh, it's very interesting. And, you know, this is typical. I've seen this many times before. It does take some time for these executive council district races and state House, state Senate races to be declared. So as you said, Dan, for listeners who want to know what's happening with those races, because they are important in terms of state policies, no change yet in what we've seen from the Associated Press. No winners declared in any of five executive council districts, and still no winners declared in 15 of 24 state Senate races. Dean Spiliotis, you know, for a small body, five people with limited powers, there's really not that much the executive council can do. It's still managed to make itself heard in recent years. What have you observed there, Dean?
Absolutely. It's really become a fairly visible, certainly among people who follow politics closely, a fairly visible platform for launching a political career in the state. You know, we've seen a number of people, Governor Sununu included, who started off there. You know, Andrew Belinsky ran for governor, Colin Van Ostern, who was defeated by Governor Sununu, also on the executive council. The campaigns have become more professionalized. We've talked before about the nature of the five districts, and you know, for example, that second ED, executive council district is typically a Democratic seat. Others are typically Republican. That we can get into a discussion of redistricting at some point. It is fascinating. It's such an unusual institution. People in other parts of the country have no idea what it is, but it has been fascinating to me. I mean, it's true to some extent for state Senate races as well, but this particular institution in our state has become just a fascinating training ground, launching pad, whatever word you want to use, for statewide office. And you can tell that's the case because you see the tremendous interest in running for those seats when they open up occasionally or to challenge an incumbent. And as you know, we've just discussed that it can have real implications for the makeup of the state court system, real implications for, you know, who heads the various departments in the state. And also, you know, we've had, you know, now legendary battles over funding for organizations like Planned Parenthood with state contracts. So, very important, very unique, and increasingly a desirable office if you have higher political aspirations.
Well, again, to let listeners know, even though the top of the ticket races have been settled, in these other also very important races. So you can go to nhpr.org to follow results, to get updates throughout the day. Again, nhpr.org. All of you are going to take a very quick station break. When we come back, we will talk a little bit about the U.S. Senate race, also the first and second congressional districts. And listeners, let's keep hearing from you. Tell us how your voting day went, what you thought of the process this year, and of course, your reaction to New Hampshire's election results. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can call 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on New Hampshire's election results and how the voting itself went, with roughly a quarter of Granite Staters casting ballots absentee. Let's get your reaction to how key races here ended up and your stories about your voting experience by absentee or at the polls. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Dan Barrett, NHPR's news director, Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, and Paula Tracy with In-Depth NH. And all of you, let's turn to the race for U.S. Senate, which was called almost as early as the governor's race, incumbent Democrat Jean Shaheen winning an easy and early victory. Here is Senator Shaheen, after her victory, calling for unity.
Our nation is in crisis. We need to work together. We need to rebuild, and if we do, we will come through this even stronger than before. Yeah. New Hampshire and the nation want us to come together. They want us to get support to those who are in need. That means more help for our small businesses, more help for our schools and hospitals, for childcare, and for our states and local communities. And it means a national plan to get this virus under control.
Again, that's Democratic U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, easily winning a third term. Paula Tracy, what stands out to you about this U.S. Senate race?
Well, one thing that I thought was interesting is how close the Joe Biden vote and the Shaheen vote were, and that she, in the last few weeks of her campaigning, really focused on the pandemic and the impact on local businesses, particularly tourism, restaurants, and getting more aid. I thought perhaps Messner might have made better inroads, inroads on those issues, as the fact that the governor kept pointing out that the Senate and the House couldn't do anything on a second stimulus package that would have helped. And I think it sort of surprised me that he didn't get more of a vote there. But she is, you know, one of the best known politicians in the state. You know, she was by Corky's own description, a very popular governor. And I think that really helped her with the vote. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the U.S. Senate, how the makeup works. But I expect that she will be putting her arms, her sleeves up, and getting to the table to try to get a second stimulus package as soon as possible.
And Dan Barrick, a question for you. Why didn't Republicans put up someone with more experience who was better known? Corky Messner, a relative newcomer to the state and brand new to state politics. I'm just curious about that, Dan.
You know, that's a good question. And I imagine many New Hampshire Republicans are asking themselves that same question this morning and have for weeks. If you actually remember back to the GOP primary just a couple months ago, the two candidates, Corky Messner and retired Brigadier General Don Bolduc, were both political newcomers who thought that they had a shot at facing Shaheen. I think in part it was a decision by perhaps more experienced Republicans who might have considered a candidacy, just looking at Shaheen and saying they just didn't think that was a race that could be won. So yes, Messner was in this race with considerable disadvantages given his lack of ties to the state, his familiarity with the state's political culture, and his own inexperience as a candidate. But I think a lot of, you know, ambitious Republicans in the state probably just saw Jeanne Shaheen in a presidential year is an opponent who is going to be a tough run. There were rumors, if you remember, earlier on, but you know, much earlier in this race, that Governor Sununu might be contemplating a run, and he seemed to sort of, you know, dance around that for a little while before, you know, finally making it clear. He obviously would have been a pretty strong opponent, but the fact that, you know, you had no other more experienced, seasoned Republican candidate stepping up, I think tells you as much more about Jeanne Shaheen than it does about you know, the state of the candidacy on the right.
Let's turn all of you to the first congressional district, often called a swing district. So, Dean, just remind us very quickly of the political history there, please.
Yeah, this is the first congressional district, which is, you know, the kind of people tend to visualize it as the eastern half of the state, particularly the southeastern corner. This is the seat that for a long period of time swung back and forth. Jeb Bradley held the seat, and then Carol Shea Porter won the seat, and then she went into an extended period of alternating holding the seat with the former Manchester Republican Mayor Frank Ginta. So for a
number
of years,
it was like a decade, Dean, right? Like,
yeah,
back and forth,
yeah,
between the two.
Exactly.
Of them.
Yeah, exactly. About a decade of swinging back and forth between a progressive and Carol Shea Porter and Frank Ginta, who certainly when he won in 2010 painted himself as a Tea Party rebel and conservative. That was a district that for many years got a lot of attention from the national parties in terms of money and resources. That didn't happen this time. I think even though there was some polling to suggest that Matt Maurer was closing the gap, I think people who study that district closely never really felt that Pappas was in any serious danger. You know, the big difference with Chris Pappas is he's not typically viewed by New Hampshire voters as an ideological politician. Even if he votes the vast majority of the time with the Democrats in the House and Nancy Pelosi, he doesn't really fit the mold of a left-wing Democratic politician where you might have some kind of reaction back to the other side, like we did with Ginta and Shea Porter. And so I think that helped him. I mean, I've over the last couple of years, I've talked to Republicans who generally vote almost straight ticket Republican, but like Chris Pappas. And I think he's been good at picking off independents, moderate Republicans. And I think the lack of interest from the Republican National Committee in terms of resources for Maurer's signaled that, you know, maybe at least for now, this district isn't swinging quite as much as it has. And that may be a function of the changing demographics in the state. We know Democratic registrations are up, but it also, I think, in part is a function of Pappas's approach to representing the district. And I think it has served him well thus far, certainly to win his reelection.
Let's hear a little bit from Congressman Chris Pappas. Here he is addressing supporters on Facebook Live a little bit before his race had been called.
You know, public service has never been a political game to me. It's always been about making people's lives better. And before we even begin to think about the next term, we've got critical work to do on that front over the next 2 months. I'll keep fighting for bipartisan COVID relief legislation that will help our families, our small businesses, and our communities weather this ongoing pandemic. And it shouldn't have taken this long to get the Senate and the administration to agree to new terms. But we certainly can't wait until a new Congress is sworn in January to provide the relief and the help that the American people need. I'll also keep working to ensure that the government is funded and that the residents of this district get the constituent services that they need. You know, it's the honor of my lifetime to represent my home state in Congress, and I'm so eager to get back to work.
Again, that's Congressman Chris Pappas addressing supporters last night. I'd like to talk a little bit about the second congressional district, if we could. And Paula, to you first. So Dean described how the first district had spent at least a decade going back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. What about the second district, Paula? How would you describe the political personality of that district?
Well, Annie Custer is now going to have her fifth term. She beat Charlie Bass, as I recall, about a decade ago, in what is considered to be a fairly Democratic leaning now. It was more moderate back a decade ago in terms of more center. But she has shown that she is a very strong candidate. Negron lost to her by, I think, 14 points or 13 points. And it was a little closer last night. It was 11 points, yeah, versus 13 from the last time around. And she has made her mark. I do think both Pappas and Custer in the beginning days of the pandemic did a real good service to themselves by offering these Zoom calls to the public and got leaders from Dartmouth Hitchcock, leaders from labor, to talk about the issues of the state and really engaged people on a non-partisan way on how they would reach out to their constituents to help them. And I think that really sort of depoliticized it a little bit. So I'm not surprised with the outcome. Mr. Negron has had two bites at the apple here, and I think it's possible that he'll try it again, but I don't know. Or maybe the Republicans will find somebody else that would be more competitive. But she, her grandfather was the governor of the state. Her mother was a state senator, and her name recognition is very strong now, along with Shaheen I think Andy Custer is a formidable candidate if she wants to run again.
Well, talking about Steve Negron and Dan Barrick, I'll turn to you, a businessman. This was his second bite at the apple, as Paula put it, a former Republican lawmaker from Nashua. How much, Dan, did Steve Negron fit the profile of the kind of Republican who could win in the second district? And I'm not talking about get the nomination, but actually win.
As both Paula and Dean pointed out, the district has increasingly become inhospitable to Republicans over the last decade. I mean, if you go back, it was for a long time the district that sort of represented a kind of old-fashioned Yankee Republican. This is a district, you know, Paula mentioned Charlie Bass, who held it for over a dozen years. This is where Judd Gregg, you know, kind of got his political start representing this district, and even back into the 70s and earlier, James Cleveland. It is now pretty, you know, with Andy Custer's track record now, pretty well about as close a lock as in New Hampshire as you can get on a Democratic district. So he had that running going against him. And I think, you know, despite the fact that he ran 2 years ago, I still largely, you know, Custer had both the advantage of name recognition and the fact that she has in her years in Congress has really grown to become a very formidable fundraiser, using the advantages of incumbency and just her own willingness and ability to raise money to really outspend Republicans and dominate the race through that way. So it was a pretty tough haul for Negron, even given his experience from 2 years earlier. I'm not sure that really gave him that much of an advantage heading into this year's contest.
One last question for all of you, and it's reverting back to just the remarkable surge in absentee ballots that we saw and just how well things did seem to go. I mean, there will be probably issues that crop up, but so far the consensus seems to be things went pretty darn well here in New Hampshire yesterday. What does, Dean, the enthusiastic embrace of absentee ballots by Granite Staters this year say for the next election? Are people going to say, you know, this was really great, I want to do it again?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've thought about that on occasion as well, as I've watched so many people embrace an opportunity to either vote by mail or to just vote early when it fits into their schedule in the weeks preceding the election. And, you know, I mean, part of this is just like any other adaptation to new technology and new ways of doing things. You know, it's going to happen in fits and starts. I think people are going to see some aspects of it that they like. A lot of it is going to depend on where we are with the pandemic in 2 years at the next midterm. But the other issue is that, you know, if in the end, and we don't know yet, but if in the end, the whole process of mail-in and starts to really looks like it's favoring Democrats, you're going to have some pushback from Republicans. We're already seeing a variety of lawsuits over this. So I think more people will embrace it, but I don't necessarily think it's going to be a smooth and easy transition if people simply want to do that. I think there's going to be some pushback from whichever party believes it is not in their self-interest to do away with it. But there's no denying. I've just talked anecdotally with a lot of people of both parties who were kind of amazed at how easy and liberating it was to be able to plan their vote and do it when they were ready and under the conditions that made them feel comfortable. I think we're moving in that direction, but I can't really predict yet whether it's going to be a smooth transition given some of the implications for the two parties and how they do ultimately on election day.
Sure, and we all got kind of an education on how voting happens in other states, you know, absentee, early voting, and so forth. And Paula, you said that you spoke a couple times before the election with Secretary of State Bill Gardner. He has long praised the tradition of casting ballots on election day. But hey, it's always a Tuesday. People work. People have childcare issues. Might there be a push, Paula, to adopt some practices that we've seen in other states, early voting, easier absentee, and so forth?
Yeah, I've spoken to Secretary Gardner about the idea of abandoning the ballot box or the polling, and he is against that. He feels that it is very important for us to have that interface as a community, and that I think he would support more of a hybrid system, as well as I think the state would. Sometimes when there's a crisis like we're dealing with now, a pandemic, we had to do this. We had to try to accommodate as many people as possible in an absentee. And I think now that we've seen it and done it and said, oh, we can add this to our success, that there will be more pressure to provide no excuse absentee option. And I think that that will be something that a lot of people will support. But I know that I look at states like Colorado, and where there's no actual it's like the town meeting process. There's this feeling that when you go and you're part of a community and you vote, that says something, and that you're making a statement on that particular day that is important to our voting heritage. And so I think what, as Dean and Dan were saying, it's probably going to be a slower process.
All right. But, Paul, I got to cut you off there, and I do apologize. It was a late night for all of you. I deeply appreciate you being with us. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Dan Barrick, NHPR's news director, Paula Tracy, senior reporter for In-Depth NH, and Dean Spiliotis with SNHU. I want to invite listeners to join NHPR for a special broadcast of The Exchange tonight at 8. After a long and tumultuous election season, we're going to open the phones. How do you feel now that this day is over? What are your thoughts? And are you confident this country can move forward after years of bitter division? You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Listen tonight live at 8 on NHPR and nhpr.org. Today's program was produced by Exchange senior producer Ellen Grimm. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.